brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you? Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant sipping on his La Croix mineral water.
Yeah, it's delicious.
And this isn't even sponsored by La Croix.
They should
that was
be
a free
at this
ad.
Point. We've done this like two or three times.
Yeah, I agree. La Croix, call us. And since you put the two of us, a couple of microphones, and an ice cold can of refreshing La Croix mineral water together, you have something called Stuff You Should Know. It's a podcast. It's a podcast.
I'm looking to see who makes this, actually. Oh, no. I thought it was going to say like Coca-Cola in small letters.
Is it La Croix?
No, it's Sundance Beverage Company.
Oh, yeah, they're huge.
From Minnesota, I think.
That's perfect. That is a perfect sponsor for Stuff You Should Know. A little guy that's producing a great product.
Agreed.
La Croix. So, Chuck.
Yes.
I've got an intro today.
Awesome. I miss these.
Stop criticizing me.
No, I mean...
So, very recently, a trio of Brits, economists, British economists... They're like walking saltines.
They're very exciting.
But anyway, these guys did something pretty cool. They studied bank robberies. And their study was published in a journal called Significance. It's actually kind of a cool journal. It takes statistics and applies it to real-world stuff. So it's an interesting statistics journal.
Interesting.
If there is such a thing. And if there is, this is it.
Yeah.
And what these guys found was that bank robbery is actually a really terrible way to make a living.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Morally, economically, it's a terrible way to make a living, too.
Oh, sure.
The
payoff is no good.
Right, yes. They looked at a lot of variables, like the number of people involved, and they found that the bigger the gang, the more, the bigger the haul, I guess. But it also meant that's one extra mouth to divide up amongst, unless you're like one of those bank robbers that just kills everybody afterward.
Yeah.
You don't want to get in bed with one of those guys.
Like Ben Affleck.
Or like in Heat. Wasn't there a lot of killing afterward in Heat?
Yeah, and in the Town, Ben Affleck's recent heist movie.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of killing going on there.
I was
going
to let that one walk by, but you brought it up twice.
I enjoyed it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, there's a lot of variables involved. But what they found is no matter what, in the UK, you can make off with about 31 grand. That's not bad.
Per?
Yes, and on average, that's what the take was.
Okay.
So in the UK, it's not so bad. But at the same time, 31 grand, what are you going to do with that?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to live the high life, you got to rob like four or five banks a year, easy.
Right, okay. Or if you're in the US, you have to rob a lot more than that. So the UK suffers about 106 bank robberies a year.
Yeah.
In the US, there's 12,000.
Wow.
And of those 12,000, the average take is like $4,000.
They only have how many a year? England?
106.
God, that's amazing.
They have really stiff, stiff gun laws, and I think that probably deters bank robbery because you kind of have to have a gun.
Or a note in your pocket that says something.
Well, these guys figured out that the presence of a firearm increased your take.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But anyway, so $4,300.
Yeah, that's not much at all.
No, and about a third of bank robberies, I guess in both countries, yield nothing.
Zero?
Zero.
Wow.
So it's a lot of hard work, a lot of risk for very little gain.
Yeah.
The real money is in white collar crime.
Oh, yes.
You want to make some cash quick? Maybe one good heist?
Yeah.
It's going to set you up for the rest of your life. And even if you're caught... Even if you're caught, the chances are you will have a mild, if any, penalty levied against you.
Well,
white collar's the way to go.
Yeah.
We're talking guys who tell people that they are financial investors and get friends and family and parents of the little league that they coach to give them 900 grand. There's other guys who just have little penny stock companies that pump up their stock. Prospects called stock touting.
Yeah.
And dump all of their shares.
Sure.
That's investor fraud. They make hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. It's where the real money is. And historically speaking, it has really low risk.
Yeah.
Even if you're caught.
All right. So we're endorsing white collar crime.
We're not endorsing it. I was being facetious.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant up with white collar crime in 2012.
No, as a matter of fact, it's going down. The times are definitely changing. There's a big struggle going on right now is to figuring out the just the right amount of punishment.
Yeah.
With white collar crime, because there's a lot of factors involved. It's a lot different from blue collar crime, e.g. stealing a car, robbing a bank.
Sure.
There's a lot of differences that differentiate it, that separate the two. And one of those now is the sentencing for him is probably stiffer, which is a total reversal
yeah.
from how it used to be before.
And they've also closed a lot of the club feds down that got so much press.
Yes. Well, they've changed them. They're still there. They just are changed.
Well, a lot of them were shut down, like, period.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just to ship them to real federal penitentiaries.
Penitentiaries.
That reminded me of a word that we'll definitely be hearing at some point in this podcast.
What?
It's a Ponzi.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's definitely white collar. Part of the problem with white collar crime, Josh, as you know from reading this, is that it's hard to come up with an exact definition of what constitutes it. So that's why they have a hard time getting great statistics on punishment and fines levied and how many they're catching. But I'm going to go with nonviolent crime.
Yeah.
That typically involves, and you have to say things like typically because it's kind of all over the map.
Right.
Typically involves deceit and fraud
mm-hmm.
Given by a perpetrator because of their occupation.
Yeah. And for that reason, a lot of times it's called occupational crime.
Yeah.
And if you look at it through that view, which is a very broad view of white-collar crime,
sure.
it's not just the execs in the $3,000 suits
yeah.
who are perpetrating this. It's the guy who's stealing pencils from work.
Yeah. Or
nonviolent, deceitful,
sure.
especially if somebody asks him if he did it and he says no.
Yeah.
And it's because you're granted this opportunity through your occupation.
Actually, I would call that petty theft.
But I'm saying, like, on a very, very broad definition of white-collar
yeah.
crime, that definitely counts. But for the most part, when you think of white-collar, you think about the CEOs, you think about investor fraud, embezzlement, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Feds have been after it in the United States in earnest since 1974 as far as a dedicated division.
Yeah, the FBI.
Yeah.
And that's because of Nixon, I read.
And then, despite that, about $300 billion a year, and that's a pretty rough estimate.
That's a 2010 estimate.
2010?
Yeah.
So let's talk about a few ways you can commit white-collar crime.
Yeah, because that definition you gave was, like, beautiful.
It's pretty good.
And there are some that just, like I said, investment fraud or embezzlement are just prototypical white-collar
sure.
crime.
And insider trading is one.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
Which falls under securities fraud, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a type of securities fraud.
So basically insider trading, I swear we've done something on this.
I don't think so.
It must have been in our Fannie and Freddie presentation then.
Yeah, maybe so.
Because we studied a lot of this stuff.
Did we?
Yeah, and I thought we'd done a podcast on it. I guess not. But insider trading is essentially like, let's say that you and I find out that Discovery had an awesome quarter, and so we go and buy a bunch of Discovery stock for nothing, and then it just shoots through the roof after the stock price comes up. That's insider trading.
Sure.
That's using private knowledge about a publicly traded company
yeah.
for your own gain. That's a no-no. We
or,
could both
or giving
go to
tips
jail.
To other people.
Yeah.
That would count as well. And then if
like,
they
ask
took
Martha
part,
Stewart.
Yeah, if they took part, then they would be insider traders as well.
Exactly. And right. it works the opposite way as well. Like if you find out that there's a lot of terrible information that's going to make your stock drop,
that's
and
right.
you sell before that information becomes public, you're in trouble.
Big trouble. Securities fraud, which insider trading is kind of like that,
mm-hmm.
but it is also manipulating, cooking the books, you've heard that term,
yeah.
of your own company to maybe undervalue a stock before it goes public, or, I mean, there's all different variations. But it basically involves manipulating numbers in a dishonest way.
Right, that pump and dump scheme?
Yeah.
Where it's stock touting, that's all securities fraud. And then there's antitrust violations
sure.
are another good one. This has been kind of big lately. So Google is supposedly hogging the YouTube metadata, which is preventing Microsoft from making a decent app for it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Google's like, well, it's proprietary or whatever. And
sure.
Microsoft's like, no, you gotta kind of have to share that. They're alleging an antitrust violation.
Wow.
Companies kind of police one another with that.
Oh, I'm sure.
And then also price fixing is a big one, which is like the opposite of companies policing one another. It's collusion between companies. And like Apple
right.
and book publishers fixing the prices of e-books allegedly has been going on.
Lately. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Man, it's going on all over the place.
It's a dirty, dirty, dirty world.
bribery, one of the oldest tricks in the book. Obviously, that's involves some sort of a payoff or a kickback in exchange for whatever, information. I get the bid. My company gets your bid mm-hmm. for this government job, and I get a little kickback, or I give you a little kickback, rather.
Mm-hmm.
Any kind of maybe favorable decision that can influence your company.
Yeah.
Little grease in the palm going on.
It's like, here's three high-quality frozen steaks. Please consider it. And
yes.
You say, consider granted.
And within each of these steaks is a $1 million bill.
That's not even any... That yeah. doesn't even exist.
What? Frozen steaks with money in them?
$1 million bill.
Oh, okay.
We know about frozen Deutschmarks.
Somebody sent us a dollar, by the way.
I want the dollar.
I'll give you 50 cents.
All right.
Well, I guess 33 and a third. We got to give Jerry a haircut. Don't go there.
We'll talk about it later. embezzlement?
Yeah.
Office Space. Everyone's seen the movie Office Space.
Sure.
That little program they had to like shave a cent or something off of
yeah, like, it was
every
like a
transaction.
Penny. Uh-huh.
That's embezzlement. They were given the opportunity through trust with books,
yep.
with accounting. They basically had access to the money and skimmed some off the top. That's embezzlement. Pure
trusted
and simple.
The wrong guys.
Yeah.
Money laundering, which we have done a podcast on.
Yep.
The Ponzi schemes.
Yeah.
Which we've done a podcast on. Tax evasion. Huge.
So basically, these are all the stars. There's also other ones like espionage, industrial espionage, corporate espionage.
Yeah, selling secrets.
It's white collar.
Sure.
Remember the lady who tried to sell Pepsi's secret
yeah.
to Coke?
Yeah, that was pretty hackneyed.
No, Coke's secret to Pepsi. And Pepsi was like, wait right here.
She wasn't.
And they went and called the cops.
She didn't do a real good job.
I bet she was surprised.
Yeah.
Environmental law violations, like dumping toxic waste.
Yeah, covering that up, like Aaron Brockovich style.
Yeah.
One of the things they point out in here, which is when it comes to things like your little office space scheme that you just touted,
mm-hmm.
A lot of times it's difficult to imagine victims. Like in office space, they think no one's going to miss a penny.
Right.
It's a huge company.
Right.
So you commit these crimes without realizing that someone is hurt somewhere down the line. If you dump your stock, your company stock that you know is about to tank, and I'm not saying it's understandable, but if you've like worked your whole career investing in this company with your 401k,
yeah.
you know it's about to tank, and you're like, man, I need to sell this or else I'm done for. My family's done for.
Yeah.
You don't think about the people buying the stock. They're the victims.
No, it's absolutely true. And I mean, like, you are being pawned. You are pawning your problem off on somebody
exactly.
else. But I think you paint a really, really excellent scenario.
Sure.
Like, you can, in some cases, feel bad for the white-collar criminal, especially if it's just some average Joe who's worried about his 401k.
Yeah. Or in the case of Enron, you don't feel bad for the upper dudes. You feel bad for everyone in that company that got defrauded.
Right, but they were strictly victims. They didn't.
No, that's what
they
I'm
didn't
saying.
Turn around and like try to dump their
yeah.
stocks.
But that's a very visible case of
right.
like screwing over your own employees.
But you make a good point. Like even if the criminal is sympathetic, there still is a victim. Even if it's just some amorphous trader they'll never meet. Even if the victim is some like hedge fund manager.
Yeah.
It's really tough. There's like a really weird spectrum here. There's like, I don't know if it's a bell curve or like the UV spectrum. Who knows?
Yeah.
But there's sympathies like placed in different spots. Sympathies and antipathies.
Yeah.
Placed along this, depending on who did what and what they gained from it and what their motives were.
Agreed. Because you got also have credit card fraud and computer and mail fraud. And counterfeiting and things like that, like, you know, the Nigerian
yeah.
email scams. That's yeah. white collar.
But and they're in the same boat as, like, Ken Lay and Jeff Skillings from
right.
Enron.
Exactly.
Same scummy crooks.
Or let's say you commit a little credit card fraud or bankruptcy fraud, and you're just like, this would be an easy way to get out of my debts.
Yeah.
Or I just say someone stole my credit card. It's very easy there to not envision a victim because it's Chase Manhattan Bank, and, like, they're going to notice. But what happens is they raise the rates on you and me, and all of a sudden everyone across the board is paying more money for stuff.
Yeah, Yes, that is true. That is very true.
Yeah.
And I think a good companion piece that occurred to me is to go listen to our Why Do Corporations Have the Same Rights as You?
Yeah.
One of the fundamental flaws of corporate policy is that you serve your shareholders first.
Right.
Like, you need to adhere to the law, but really, ultimately, like, anything you can do to serve your shareholders is your mandate as a corporate governor.
Right.
That includes keeping the profit margin as high as possible.
Yeah.
Which, you're not going to go to your shareholders and be like, hey, we're making enough money. We took kind of a hit, but we're still making a ton of profit.
Right.
So we'll just take a little hit this year. No, it's... We took a hit, so we're going to fire people.
Yeah.
However you reconcile that, I mean, that's your own personal beliefs, like what you feel about that. But that is reality as far as business goes, right?
Agreed.
There's fraud. There's adjustments to the fraud, the absorbing the fraud, and it's the corporation trying to get as lean as possible.
Yeah, they're not going to take the hit for that.
No.
They're not going to say, oh, well, a bunch of people defaulted on their credit cards this year. I guess we'll just have a bad year.
No. And I know in reality that's how it works, but I just find it disingenuous to be like, well, everybody suffers. You know, like, people lose their jobs because of fraud. It's like there's a point B in there that has to be held accountable to some degree.
Well, which is your own friggin' ethical code of conduct. And, like, how about not doing that because it's the wrong thing to do?
No, but I'm saying, like, there's an institution that's absorbing the hit and then turn around and firing this poor guy.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just, it's tough because I came across a word when they were describing white collar crime, giving a definition of it, and they said victims, diffuse.
Yeah.
You don't meet the person,
yeah.
The victim passes along the hit to other people. It's nebulous.
Yeah. And even if they're raising rates by like a quarter of a percentage point, or you're paying an extra $2 as a consumer a year, it's like, it's still not right.
Yeah.
You know?
It's not right all over the place, Chuck.
It's not right all over the place.
So where did this come from?
Josh, it sounds like it came from a cold wool delivery boy. I want to know more about this. Was this dude just cold, or did he really steal a lot of wool?
No, so you're talking about the Carrier's case.
The Carrier's case of 1473-ish.
It's the first white-collar trial.
Yes.
And it resulted in the first white-collar law in 15th century England. And this wool transporter was given a bunch of wool and said, hey, take this wool to this person. And it was his job.
Yeah.
So he decided to instead just keep the wool for himself, for his own use.
Okay. So you looked into this more?
Yeah.
I thought he might have been, like, cold on his journey.
No.
And said, you know, I'm going to keep some of this wool.
No, he kept some of the wool. I think he kept all of it.
Okay.
But somebody gave it to him. He's like, thanks, chump.
So he was a jerk after all.
He was. But the key is, and this is something that is woven into the history of white-collar crime, what he did was not illegal at the time.
Right.
The law that was enacted as a result of the Carrier's case was, they were saying, okay, this isn't illegal, but it's obviously there's a huge problem with this, so we're going to create a law that outlaws this act so people can't do it anymore.
Good point. And basically that's what happened. Well, that's kind of what happens with every law, I guess. Someone commits it first, and then someone says, hey, maybe we shouldn't do that.
Yeah, I guess.
But in this case, especially, like the Industrial Revolution in the West, obviously, you started getting these larger corporations, and all of a sudden things like monopolies and price fixing and employee safety and all these things come into effect for the first time. So that's sort of when it was really born and when they started saying, hey, we need to look at something called antitrust.
Yeah, again, like, monopolies were not illegal, but when a company bought up all of its competitors and said, oh, suddenly the price for your groceries are like through the roof.
Right.
Where else are you going to go? It wasn't illegal, but the people of the world started screaming and governments finally responded. And it was really the U.S. that first had the real first solid response in the Sherman Antitrust Act. In like the 1870s, maybe, I think? 1890s.
Yeah, 1890, named for Senator John Sherman of Ohio, Republican dude.
Yeah.
Chairman of the Senate Finance Committee.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know they even had way back then.
I didn't either, but I mean, it seems like a basic committee there.
So this is interesting in that it was voted on. It won by a vote of, in the Senate, 51-1, in the House by 242-0.
Wow.
So there was one dude that didn't vote for it. And then I think 25 years later, when they came up with the Clayton Antitrust Act to really put some punch into the Sherman Act,
yeah,
it was 277 to 74 and 46 to 16. So in that 24 years, it sounds like maybe things got slightly corrupt here and there.
Well, it wasn't that. It was that. Well, maybe it was.
Yeah.
But there was also some real problems with the Sherman Act. It was really vague.
Yeah.
It basically said, like, now from here forth, all anti-competitive corporate measures are illegal.
Right.
And then it left it to the courts to decide what was what, and the courts weren't really in the mood to enforce it. So it went largely unenforced. Although American Tobacco Company and Standard Oil, like two of the biggest companies in the country, were dissolved under the Sherman Act.
Yeah, Standard Oil, big time.
Imagine that. Like, imagine going to a company now and saying, like, hey, Apple, you're just too big.
Yeah.
So we're going to dissolve you into 31 companies. We have all these federal regulators here, and they're going to come in and look at everything and then dissolve you into different companies. Sorry. That's what they did.
Yeah.
Okay, even still, it didn't have enough teeth, so they came up with the Clayton Antitrust Act. And then that one really spelled things out. Like, you couldn't do price discrimination anymore.
Right.
Which, if you were black in America during the Jim Crow era, price discrimination was mind-boggling.
Oh, yeah. You walk into a store, if you're allowed in there to begin with, and they'll just make up whatever price they want.
Yeah. It was really... I'm reading this Consumerism in America book, and it's at this point now, and it's really just this blemish on American history.
Yeah.
I mean, like, slavery wasn't bad enough.
And
we had to, like, have slavery light through the Jim Crow era.
Yeah.
It's just disgusting.
Exactly.
Okay, so there was no price discrimination, allegedly. Corporate mergers were outlawed.
In the Clayton
Act? And then interlocking boards where you had, like, competitive companies.
Yeah.
But the same people on the board of each.
Right, right.
You can't have that. And then also exclusive contracts where it's like, hey, Home Depot, you can sell our weed whackers, but you can't sell anybody else's. Those
right.
contracts are out.
Right.
Hey, Home Depot.
They do stuff like that now, though, right? Maybe not exclusively, but they carry, like,
they do now.
Very limited number of brands.
Corporate mergers, interlocking boards, exclusive contracts.
Oh, all that stuff went away?
It all got chipped away.
Okay.
It's just, I mean, this act is, like, not in force anymore, basically.
Well, that's one of the things that bugs me about, like, grocery, or actually the big box hardware stores, grocery shopping. You only have access to who they have partnered with.
Right.
Whether it's your potato chip that you want or your weed whacker that you want.
It's true. And most of the big box stores also have exclusive contracts the other way. It's like, yeah, we'll sell your weed whacker, but you can't sell it. No one else can.
Right.
So it's like a real gamble, I understand, to, like, sign on to one of these giant corporations.
Well, that's one in the Walmart effect. That was one of the things. I think they used like a tent company or a awning company.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, this mom-and-pop awning company all of a sudden gets a Walmart contract, and they're like, sweet. They answered all our prayers. They ordered, like, 30,000 of these.
Mm-hmm.
They order 30,000. They open up, like, three new buildings, hire all these employees, and then the next year they come back and say, we want 30,000 more, but we're going to pay you about 60% less, and you've already bought the buildings, and you've invested in the materials and the people, and all of a sudden you're screwed.
You know, one thing that I've long thought, and I'm going to totally take flack for this, but I still think it's worth saying. Like, you hear, like, well, that's just business.
Yeah,
I feel that any institution where, like, morally reprehensible acts can just be, you know, offhandedly
sure.
dismissed as a matter of course.
Yeah.
Of that institution is inherently flawed. There's an inherent problem with it.
Yeah.
That's not okay.
Agreed.
Like, we don't just go, well, that's just murder.
Right.
You know? Or, well, that's just stealing.
Yeah.
You know? Welcome to Earth, human.
Right.
No. We have moral and legal guidelines that we follow, and business and corporations have so long stood outside of these things.
Right.
That it's just, it always bugs me when it's just like, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
I don't like that. So, sorry, I'm off my soapbox.
No,
now.
I agree completely.
I'm off of my Tide brand soapbox.
Well said. So things are kicking along here in the industrial West. Corporations are getting larger. And all of a sudden, these crimes start happening. And something called a muckraker
mm-hmm.
in the 19th and early 20th century comes about. And I didn't realize a muckraker was exclusively a journalist.
Yeah, it's another name for an investigative journalist.
I thought it was anyone raking muck.
No.
But it's specifically a journalist who basically early on said, you know what? There's bad stuff going on, see?
Yeah.
And I'm going to expose you.
Right. Upton Sinclair was one.
Oh, really?
And he wrote The Jungle, changed.
Oh, of course.
I mean, the FDA basically came about because of that investigation that he conducted.
Well, muckrakers raked a lot of muck and caused a lot of problems in these companies. And one of the things that came about because of the muckraking were, you know, things like the Clayton Act.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Exposing all the stuff.
Exactly. And things like the FDA, federal regulations, consumer protections. The muckrakers basically stirred up public sentiment like, hey, don't be idiots. Like, this stuff's going on.
Right.
And a lot of people said, well, it's not illegal. And then, fortunately, there were guys like E.A. Ross, who was a criminologist and a sociologist. And he started really kind of looking into this and said, hey, man, these people might not be criminal, but let's call them criminaloids. Like, that was the term
really?
He coined for people who, especially in business, carried out these terrible acts that weren't illegal. He argued that even though it's not illegal,
yeah,
they're causing ill, and these people are still responsible for them. So make a law that outlaws it, dummies.
Yeah, yeah.
And he inspired a guy named E.H. Sutherland.
Okay, he came before Sutherland?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
He was at the Ross was working at the time of the Muckrakers, and then Sutherland came about 20 years later.
Yeah, Sutherland coined the term, actually, white-collar crime in 1939, and he was a criminologist and sociologist, and he pretty much... He had a broader definition that basically it was the high society and not the lower class at all committing these crimes.
Right.
Which nowadays you can't really say that because anyone can get a stock tip.
It's
and
true.
Commit, you know, it happens all the time across all spectrums of the class system.
But Sutherland's point was, and he wrote a book called White Collar Crime.
Yeah.
His point was is that there is a huge bias in the United States where law enforcement and the courts leaned heavily on the working class crimes,
sure,
and just basically ignored the crimes of the upper class.
Yeah,
and said this is not okay. Like, if a guy's going to steal $1,000 from a cash register with no gun or anything like that,
right?
Like, there are other factors, but let's just say a guy steals $1,000 from a cash register and he's poor, and a guy steals $1,000 from an investor and he's rich.
Mm-hmm.
They should be treated equally, and they're
right.
Not. And that's what Sutherland's point was.
And he was the first dude to really bring this to light, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, Ross kind of started too, but Sutherland was very well received.
It was well received in certain corners, but there were also certain flaws pointed out by people over the years. One of the things mentioned in the article is said that he failed to distinguish illegal crime from mere deviant behavior.
Right. Like, apparently his whole premise was like, you're into donkeys. You're a white-collar criminal.
Exactly. And the other thing I mentioned, too, was that he pretty much said it was anyone, like any upper-class nonviolent crime.
Right. And that's definitely evolved, and I think fairly.
Sure.
I think you can be working class. You can be business class. If you, like, that's a big part of white-collar crime's definition is that your opportunity arises because of the trust that's granted to you through your occupation.
Yeah, even if you're a lower-level employee,
mm-hmm,
you still may have access, like the lady who wanted to sell the Coke secret. She wasn't like a CEO.
She was an admin, I believe.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's one thing that like you said, they like to shoot a hole in Sutherland's theory that... Or they say his definition's too broad because he did include behavior that's not illegal. But it's a very legitimate point to say you kind of have to, because if not, then we wouldn't have had the Sherman Antitrust Act. We wouldn't have had the Clayton Act. We
right.
wouldn't have had the FDA, all of these things that the Carrier's case, he would have gotten off scot-free.
Yeah.
What he did was not illegal. So
yeah,
it has to evolve over time.
Agreed.
Okay. And it has.
Agreed.
So let's talk about, I guess, the impacts of today's modern white-collar crime.
I was like, man, that was suspenseful all of a sudden.
Thanks, dude.
Yeah, we've talked about a few of these, about it seemingly not having a victim. But what happens is you rip off a huge corporation, they'll raise the prices. There's another ripple effect.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about cutting jobs to meet, the needs of the investors if it's a publicly traded company.
Right.
When there's stock fraud committed, insider scandals like Enron are going to ripple out.
Oh my God.
Throughout the stock market, cause like, you know, basically cause people to be unsure and have no faith in the stock market all of a sudden.
Yeah.
That's dangerous.
Yeah. Think about all the people who just lost everything.
I know.
Oh my God.
I get just as angry, if not more angry, at something like that than, you know, some like heinous crime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd say equal.
Yeah.
They're both scumbags.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you said like in 1974 the FBI first started. That's when they created this white collar crime division.
Yeah.
So apparently like
1974.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was a response like this University of Michigan survey that they conducted between 1958, I think, and 1973. They found that people who said that they trust the federal government went from 73% to 37%.
And then apparently, what span of time?
Between 1958 and 1973.
Wow.
Yeah, it flip-flopped.
Yeah,
in that short of time.
I could see that over that time period, the 60s.
Yeah, one of the big ones was just like fraud and corruption at high levels. And so the FBI created this white-collar crime thing. One of the other things that differentiates white-collar crime from regular working-class crime,
yeah,
is the police's ability to police it.
Right.
You walk into a room and there's some guy weighing out cocaine. He's a criminal.
Yes.
You walk into a room and there's some guy on a computer doing a pump and dump scheme. Who knows?
Yeah.
The average cop isn't equipped to detect this kind of crime.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, even very, very well-trained cops aren't typically equipped to detect this kind of crime. One of the hallmarks of white-collar crime is that it's very difficult to prove.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to uncover.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also difficult to prosecute.
Yeah, and there's no smoking gun. There's no paper trail.
Yeah.
Or there may be a paper trail, but it's probably electronified.
Sure.
So it's a little harder to follow. You got to really, you know, you got to have people that know what they're doing.
Right.
And that's why the FBI created that division. And I guess they're doing a good job, but it's kind of hard.
Well, the Justice Department has been going after white-collar crime lately under Obama pretty hard here or there. And then the Sarbanes-Oxley Act definitely stepped things up.
And 2002.
Some say too much.
Yeah, I mean, I've had to comply with this at various when I worked in the film business, production companies had to like jump through way more hoops with paperwork because of Sarbanes-Oxley.
Yes. Do you want to tell them?
Well, it was in 2002, and it was to improve corporate governance, which is basically accountability between the corporation and the stakeholders. What it amounted to was a lot more paperwork, essentially.
A lot
more proving of numbers and showing numbers and jumping through hoops.
It was a direct reaction from the fallout of Enron and Tyco and like all the other companies around that time. But one of the other things it did, Chuckers, was it quadrupled sentences in a lot of cases for white-collar crime.
Yeah.
So now you have guys like Bernie Madoff getting 150 years. There's a guy named Sholem Weiss who was involved in like the breakup of some insurance company. He got 845 years.
Wow.
He gets out in 2754.
I don't think he's going to see that.
I don't either. But, I mean, a guy named Rich Harkness got 100 years for a $39 million Ponzi scheme. Like, these, and all of this is, like, post-Sarbanes-Oxley.
Yeah.
Except Sholem Weiss, which is really saying something. But
he still got that kind of sentence.
But, I mean, like, so now sentences are, like, quadruple. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Maybe this is a little too much.
Like, just retribution on the rich.
It is. And that's kind of, I think, why a lot of people are having a hard time feeling bad for ridiculously wealthy people who were hucksters and frauds.
Yeah.
Or people who bilked people out of their retirement accounts. It's tough to feel sorry for them. But legally speaking, it's like, well, wait a minute. You were worried about the guy who stole $1,000 out of a till.
Right.
Being treated differently from the guy who stole $1,000 from an investor. Now it's flip-flopped. How is that any better?
Exactly.
One of the arguments for these kind of things is that these people are traditionally and historically have been treated differently because they look like the judges that are sentencing them.
Yeah.
And so judges historically like really have taken it easy on them.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and just call them white dudes.
Okay. But they also have been you can make the case that they are usually first-time offenders. They're usually family people. That's something that the judges put out there.
Yeah.
Like, well, this is a family man. He's not much of a flight risk. He's probably never going to do this again.
Yeah, is he a danger to society?
Yes, he didn't use a weapon,
yeah.
Which is a huge, huge differentiation.
Yeah.
And so sentences have typically been light. But you can also kind of say, well, you know, where it feels like we haven't quite felt it out. Like, we've traditionally ignored white-collar crime. Now we're really sticking it to them.
Well, it's that whole argument with prison. Is it like punishment for a crime done, or is it rehabilitating a person who has a problem with crime?
Well, with an 845-year sentence, it's yes. making an example out of that person.
Sure.
Because since you can't police it, another way to prevent it is
yeah.
to send a message through the courts. Like, you do this, man, you're going to prison for a long time.
Yeah, I don't know if that's such a deterrent, though, for some of these people.
I don't know. I mean, think about it. 20 years in a federal pen, you say Club Fed is not around any longer.
Yeah, true.
And I mean, this is like 20 actual years.
Yeah.
Some guy named Thomas Petters recently got 50 years, and he will spend 40 years in jail, and he's 52, and he will probably die in prison now. That's a big deal to somebody who's like, well, maybe I shouldn't do this insider trade. Maybe I should let yeah. this 50 grand just walk by because it's not really worth it.
Well, something like that. I'm talking about the ones who are getting rich by the tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
What I want to see is that these people don't get out of prison and still have all those millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Like hidden in different foreign accounts and
yeah.
offshore islands and like the financial part is what really bugs me. I meant to look up and see if any of the Enron victims and employees were ever repaid or if they were just SOL.
I'm under the distinct impression they were SOL.
Really?
Because the company was in such bad shape that even dissolving it and
it's just like,
splitting
sorry,
its assets up.
No,
I think they some people did get some money,
yeah.
but I don't think it was anything approaching what they lost.
Well, if whoever commits these crimes gets out of jail and they have two pennies to rub together, then those two pennies more than they should have, I think.
Well, that's the thing. Like, so the government started prosecuting under the RICO Act,
yeah.
which is the same thing they bust up mafia organizations with. And they've been fighting white-collar crime with that. And one of the things about the RICO Act is it allows states and individuals who are harmed to sue for up to three times the damages.
Yeah, but even then, all they have to do is say, yeah, I don't have that money. Are you kidding me?
Well, it's true.
Can't pay it.
No, it's true. But like in the Madoff case, the guy who was assigned to basically get money back for investors
yeah.
has gotten... I don't remember how much Madoff fleeced, but let's say it was $8
billion. Okay.
The guy's managed to like get like $6 billion back.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's done a really good job of,
wow.
of getting the money back. And that's just that's an example. That's not
yeah,
an actual figure,
real.
But it's something pretty significant.
You're still going to get an email.
It wasn't $8 billion.
I'm looking forward to the ones where it's like, hey, man, we don't listen to you for free to hear your opinion about class.
All right, let's move on to other countries. Things are different all over the world. Obviously, when it comes to big business and business dealings, Western Europe has followed right behind the U.S. Most wholeheartedly with laws to prevent corruption. Eastern Europe is coming on board a little slower.
Mm-hmm.
But then you go into other countries like in Western Africa, and it may be customary to grease palms to get a deal going.
Right.
Or in India, where apparently if you're a truck driver, you're going to have to bribe people to keep your rig on the road.
Right.
And that's just how it is there.
Right. And not only is it customary, it's frequently legal.
Yeah. Russia?
Yeah.
Bribes all over the place. If you want a land contract, you might have to bribe somebody.
So if you're a multinational corporation...
It's tough to do
that's
business.
Headquartered in America.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have like a real problem facing you, especially, like I said, the Justice Department under Obama has been prosecuting white-collar crimes and going big time after people under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
Oh, really?
Which says if you're an American company, you can't engage in bribes even if
right.
it's legal in that country.
Well, good.
Yeah. But what's the point? Like, why hamstring American business abroad?
Yeah, exactly. And to help this out, actually, there has been a unified committee called the committee called Transparency International, and they are out to get rid of corruption and to unify business ethics all over the world.
Right, and that's the reason that you hamstring American business, because
yeah.
it's basically saying, hey, we can take the hit in the hopes of pressing the rest of the world into the same
clean up their act
competitive laws we have here in the States
that
work very well.
So good luck to them.
Yeah. That's it, man.
I got nothing else.
No. We should play this one out with the Talking Heads' Big Business, okay?
Agreed.
Okay. So, Chuck, let's see. If people want to learn more about white-collar crime, I would strongly advise them to go read this article by Jane McGrath. She did a good job. And there's a Simpsons reference in it, so way to go, Jane. You can type in white-collar crime in the search bar at HowStuffWorks.com, which, friendo, brings up listener mail.
That's right, Josh. I'm going to call this hot off the presses, good cause. I'm a sucker for that stuff.
Okay.
Chuck and Josh and Jerry, I want to say thank you for all the hours of listening. My brother Chase and I have been listeners nearly as long as you have been making them. There was even one New Year's Day where all we would do was listen to your Hangover podcast on repeat. Yeesh. I don't know if that's good for a hangover.
Yeah.
It's funny and informative, and I always feel like calling my brother after listening to the latest episode. I'm writing you because it's recently his birthday. He's the best brother in the world and downright awesome human being. It would mean a lot to me if you could tell the Stuff You Should Know listeners about his latest project. When his friend Jim survived cancer, he told Chase that he gained strength from the music he loved. Over 2 years, 2,600 tracks. 2,600 tracks. That's a weird way to put it. What would that be? 2,600, would that be?
Wait, how many? 2,600?
Yeah.
That'd be 2,800.
Would it? Or 2,200?
No, 2,600 plus 200 is 2,800.
Nearly 200 artists from all over.
This person's insane.
No, she's not.
Oh, okay.
Over 2 years, 2,600 tracks, nearly 200 artists from other countries all over the world have allowed them to share that message. They are releasing their second compilation disc, Electronic Saviors, Industrial Music to Cure Cancer. So it's these artist compilations they're putting together.
Gotcha.
Apparently 2,600 tracks. They are a registered U.S. Charity, and all proceeds go to cancer research. And if you're into electronic music, and if you want to support cancer research,
yeah,
you can go to www.electronicsaviors.com. And that is something Chase has got going, and his sister Laura Dudley is a big fan of her bro. He sounds like a swell guy.
Nice.
I'm all for it. Music.
That is good
therapy,
stuff.
Curing way cancer.
To, way to promote a good cause, Chuckers.
We try to do that.
You did good. Yeah, we always want to hear about good causes.
Yeah.
So you can get in touch with us. Let us know about yours. We'll try our best to let everybody else know about it, especially if people can support it.
Agreed.
Let's see. Also, enjoy a little Talking Heads, Big Business, from the live album Stop Making Sense, released in 1984. We're sure it's up on iTunes, Amazon, and elsewhere. You can get in touch with us at SYSK Podcast on Twitter. You can go to facebook.com/stuffyoushouldknow. And you can send us a regular old email by wrapping it up, spanking it on the bottom, and sending it off to stuffpodcast@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?